Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Managers sometimes need to have a talk with their people. Maybe it's someone who's doing too little work or low quality work, or is very aggressive, a bulldozer, or the opposite, very passive, or is being accused by a coworker of harassment. And of course, managers have to have a talk with their people when there's got to be a layoff or an individual has to get fired. My guest has been in the belly of that beast. He's been a senior HR exec for the likes of Nickelodeon and Paramount Pictures. He teaches in the UCLA Extension School of Business and the author of 9 books, including 101 Tough Conversations to Have with Employees. And it was one of the Society for Human Resource Management's great 8 books of the year. Paul Falcone, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Marty. It's nice to be here.
Good. One of the things that surprised me in your book, but it does resonate with me, is that you think that one of the most potent tools to get people to change, whether you're an HR manager, any kind of manager, is guilt. Explain that.
Yeah, people kind of take that answer out of context. But what I do is I juxtapose guilt and anger. And my point is, anger is external. As long as someone's angry at you or you're angry at them, nothing is going to get fixed. Because you assume no responsibility for any of the problem. Mm-hmm. The better human emotion is to get people feeling guilty. Now, I don't mean Aunt Edna's old guilt of putting you down. I'm talking about the sense of guilt as an emotion that makes you look internally for being part of a problem and being part of a solution.
Give me an example.
Well, it takes two to tango. So the reality is, if someone is in a conference room meeting, staff meeting, and someone on the team kind of really lets out at the boss in front of everyone else on the team, boss has two choices. One is you stand up and you scream and yell at the person and say, how dare you, and I can't believe, blah, 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 get to my office, right, which escalates things,
right.
And everyone's angry and hot.
Right.
Or it takes a different approach, which is more of a, let's talk in my office about what happened in there, and we need to kind of figure this out. But then the approach is much more guilt-driven in the sense where, this is how you made me feel, and can you understand why I was embarrassed in there? And you see the person kind of shrink away in their chair. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't realize that it came across that way.
So let me try that out. So if you were the person who, there isn't that much yelling that goes on in these corporate meetings. California especially is the land of explicit restraint. But let's say, I'm simply yes-butting you a lot in the meeting. And I'm feeling like you're just trying to be an obstructionist. Not like you're really arguing on the merits. You're trying to be an obstructionist maybe to you, for your own advantage. So, yes, I call you into the office. And then I say, I got to be honest with you. I'm not so much angry as a little disappointed in you. I recall when you were, there were some ideas that came up in some other meetings, and you were the first to either, on the merits criticize or embrace them or amplify them. And I feel, at least in this meeting, like there was some other agenda going on. And I'm wondering, is something bothering you? Is there something wrong? Would that kind of approach invoke the kind of guilt you're referring to?
Absolutely. 100%. It's a great example because you're using terms like feeling, which it made me feel like. You're using terms like perception, which is, I'm not sure where your reality is on this, but perception-wise, this is what it looked like from my vantage point. No one's going to sit there and argue that you have no right to feel a certain way or perceive something a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when you kind of create it in that very humane context, people will typically respond in kind. There'll be respect in their response, and they will look internally if there's anything they did that might have upset you in the meeting.
Yep. All right, so it's good. I'm glad we're getting specific. Let's stay in the specific mode. I'm going to present, hopefully that'll be the kind of major structure of this interview, some of the more thorny, not necessarily the most common, but the more thorny but realistic problems that a manager, HR or otherwise, might have with an employee. Now, I want to state up front, I'm well aware that most employees are good, hardworking, ethical, great folk. And though there aren't those difficult conversations that you often have to have with such folks. But the purpose of this segment is to talk about when there is a problem. So actually, let's talk about what may be, and your book says, is one of the most thorny of the problems. Let's start with that. In your book, you talk about a weak employee who's afraid of being let go. So he or she fabricates a claim like discrimination or sexual harassment. And that, of course, could make you afraid to let the person go, because that person could claim you only let her go because you were retaliating for the claim. And, of course, that's going to mean a painful, expensive law process. Now, of course, that person's claim could be absolutely legitimate. That person could be a victim of sexism and racism and everything else. How would you wisely handle such a situation?
Well, since you're getting right to the core of the matter, Marty, this makes me smile, because this does happen more than employers think.
Mm.
And you're right. It is a matter of perception. And what's right or wrong or actual or not, I don't know as a human resources guy until I sit down and start talking to people. But the funny thing is, in my world, what a lot of HR people will tell you is, it is funny how when people are all of a sudden on a final written warning, or maybe they violated the terms of their final written warning, and they're suddenly afraid they're going to get fired, all of a sudden things come up in their memory from a year ago.
About a sexual harassment thing, yeah.
And they'll come to human resources and make a proactive complaint about their boss's conduct, hopefully so that no one will bother them about their performance.
Mm-hmm. But let's make it hard. I'm going to make it really hard on you, because, of course, at that point, it's pretty obvious. If there was already clear documented evidence that the employer was trying to get rid of the employee, and then at the last minute the person comes up with some discrimination claim, there is some reason, that chain of events, that timeline, is going to make it more likely that that they're going to say, come on, this is BS, you're just trying to insulate yourself from getting let go. But the wiser employee would, before they get to progressive discipline land, and they are simply, they know their boss is kind of not treating them well, not respecting them, that person's tenure is tenuous, or even if the person isn't bad, but they sense there's going to be a layoff happening. Let's say I'm an average employee, and I'm not going to be the superstar who's going to survive a layoff, but I'm adequate, I'm fine. But I also have I'm desperate. I go, this is a terrible job market. I have a family to support, all this other stuff. So I want to add a layer of protection to myself and make this claim of harassment so that I will not be on the layoff list. How does one, if you were the manager or HR manager, how would you address that situation?
Well, it's a funny situation. As the worker, it isn't necessarily a smart strategy, because, if you really don't feel like it's valid and legitimate, and you're kind of just cooking something up to give yourself a layer of protection, probably not a smart strategy, because it's going to put you on everyone's radar screen. It's like the negative Nelly in the group who's, making these kinds of complaints, especially if they're not perceived to be valid, or it's a complaint from 4 years ago. I've seen those kinds of things, too, where all of a sudden people come up to me in human resources and say, I can't sleep anymore. I've been thinking about this. It's been bothering me. I have an obligation to disclose. Like, this happened 4 years ago. You're disclosing it now because, you know what I mean? So those things happen.
So,
but for a manager and the manager standpoint, what I usually tell managers is, listen, you have to trust your gut. You have to know when to listen to that internal voice, that guidance system that we have in us, whether you call it intuition or hunches or whatever it happens to be. Get to human resources first, because so much of this, Marty, is about the record that's created. And managers will step on these landmines and not realize that they're being set up a certain way until they find themselves on the sharp end of the investigation spear. And here's how I know that they stepped on the landmine. The employee comes in to make the complaint. I will later bring in the supervisor plus the supervisor's supervisor. We're both there in the meeting. And when I explain to that supervisor that there's been a complaint of harassment or discrimination against the person says, well, who's making that complaint? And I say, oh, John Doe. And the person looks at me and says, John Doe, you've got to be kidding. I was about to come in here and tell you that we need to put him on a final written warning. Boom, the landmine just went off. They didn't realize that they were being set up that way. So when in doubt, run, don't walk to human resources and make sure that you make the record as a supervisor in California. You have to make the record first that HR is armed with this stuff and is not thrown off after the fact.
Let me make a contrary argument. Once you go to HR, then it's got to be very legalese. And once it's very legalese, it is very confrontational and oppositional. And that's going to make the client hire a lawyer. And now it escalates really fast. What if I said, let's role play the other way around. So now you're going to be this person who I'm the person's, let's say, manager. And you came to me and you claimed sexual harassment or discrimination or whatever. And instead of my running the human resources so fast, I say to you, well, that is a very serious concern, and I certainly take every sexual discrimination or racial discrimination claim very seriously. Please tell me all the details. And I would take assiduous notes, and then I said, I will investigate this very thoroughly. I will talk to everybody involved, and I will get back to you. Now, I would think that would invoke, A, some measure of fear. If the person's not, if the person's legitimate, she's going to feel very, or he is going to feel very validated, which is great. If the person is really kind of malingering, that person's going to have a combination of fear and guilt. And I won't yet have invoked any antipathy because I'm not running to human resources. I'm not starting a legal process. I'm making that person feel I'm on his or her side and I am taking this seriously. Is there anything wrong with doing that rather than running to human resources, as you suggested?
Yeah, I'd argue that's a big mistake.
I see.
One of the things that you'll find, for example, under a typical code of conduct or corporate business ethics statement is managers are not allowed to conduct their own investigations.
Mm.
That's a general rule because you can't. First of all, you're involved. And if you're an involved party, especially the one who's being complained about.
Oh, sure, that's another story. But if it's someone complaining about somebody else, though.
No, but it's the same type of thing.
Okay.
The reason why, if your company is large enough, for example, to have an HR department, but even if they're not, you've got to take someone and make someone who's one step removed from the action and make that person the objective eyeball that does the investigation. So even if you don't have an HR department, but you have a company lawyer, or you have a VP of administration, or you have someone who, you know, handles these kinds of things as a third-party disinterested, you know, presence.
Good point.
That has to be the person who's doing these investigations. For the supervisor to say, I'll handle this. Don't worry, there's no need to go to human resources. It's only going to make it worse because at some point it'll get back to human resources. And then it's going to look like the manager is doing a cover-up.
Excellent. That's why you're the guest and I'm the host. My guest is Paul Falcone. He is the author of 101 Tough Conversations to Have with Employees. And unlike so many writers who are kind of psychologists and coach types who are kind of opining from afar, this guy has been for years an HR professional at a fairly high level, quite a high level, for the likes of Nickelodeon and Paramount Pictures. He teaches the UCLA Extension School of Business. And he's my guest here on Work with Marty Nemco. What I want to do is I'm going to actually give out the phone number. This is a perfect kind of a topic for dear listeners. If you are an employee or an employer and you are about, you think you may need to have a tough conversation with your supervisee or your supervisor and would like a real pros take on the situation, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while we're waiting for the calls to come in, let's now go to another very specific question. Let's take let's say somebody, one of your employees complains to you that a coworker isn't a team player. He or she is aggressive, is a know-it-all, a bulldozer, and that it actually does border on not sexual harassment, but just harassment per se. What would you do regarding that employee?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, a lot of times the manager sees it him or herself, but doesn't do anything with it. We sweep it under the rug and we help it just kind of fixes itself over time. But then all of a sudden one or two employees start coming forward and they start making complaints that it's too difficult to work with someone. They're always walking on eggshells around this person and they kill camaraderie in the group. Okay, the first issue is, assuming that the manager has witnessed it himself, bring that person in. You need to talk to that person about perception. One of the most important words, Marty, that I've always espoused is perception. It's not, you know, perception is reality until proven otherwise. And people can argue all they want, but that wasn't what I intended, and people shouldn't feel that way. But the bottom line is, if this is the way you're coming across, then you have a perception problem on your hands. They used to call them public relations firms. Now they call them perception management firms. When you have a conversation with someone that says, Marty, let me share with you, I think you've got a perception problem on your hands, but I'm holding you accountable for your own perception management, okay? I'm just telling you, you've got to understand this. People are regarding your type of behavior as, let me share some words they've used with you. Bully. bullying, confrontational, devoid of teamwork and camaraderie. I mean, you share with me, is it wrong? Because I've seen it myself, and I haven't had this talk with you yet, but now that other people are starting to bring it up to me, it's like, yeah, I'm seeing it too. So we need to fix this like right now.
I love it, because you are talking to me. You're not saying you are a bully. This is the perception, which is going to make the person less defensive, and yet it certainly clearly have to address it. I just think that is terrific. What about the case where sometimes there are the cases where the employee is the sharpest tool in the room, is the smartest woman or guy in the room, and he is or she is with coworkers who are less bright, less driven, less innovative. And so, yeah, after a while, he or she gets frustrated and it becomes domineering and does make people feel less than. But really, he or she is the hero. And what needs, you know, we don't want, what very often happens in groups, in workplaces, there's an attempt to tamp down the excellent to the lowest common denominator so everybody else looks bad. How do you deal with the person who really, yes, who is kind of a bulldozer, but only because he or she is brighter, more driven, cares more about the business? What do you do in that situation?
Well, there's two things. Number one, what I'll do is I'll draw a circle on a piece of paper and I cut the circle in half. And the top of the circle reads performance, and the bottom of the circle reads conduct. And I talk to people about the fact that they're responsible for both. It's not just a matter of your performance. That's not going to always save the day. That's not going to get you the highest score on your performance review. You're equally responsible for the bottom half of the circle and making everyone feel like it's an inclusive work environment where they can do their best work every day. Truth be told, and I don't mean to hurt your feelings, but you're coming across as very condescending. The words that I've used, the words that I've heard to describe the way you treat some of your coworkers is basically stuck up and arrogant. And I don't mean to hurt your feelings by saying that to you, but let's talk about, A, do you see any of this? And B, is there a reason for it? Now, that's going to get the person saying, well, Paul, I'm doing 50 miles ahead of everybody else on your team because these guys are so slow and blah, 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 blah. And what I would say is, now, that's a separate issue, and I'm glad you're telling that to me because I think there's legitimacy in what you're saying. And it'll be my responsibility, and I'd like your help and suggestions in terms of how we turn the performance level of the group around. But honestly, that doesn't excuse any kind of behavior on your part where you're showing that you are short-tempered with other people or impatient with other people.
Paul,
we've got to fix this together as a team.
Great. Paul, I don't know if this is appropriate. I'm just a human being with Marty to Paul. You should be very proud of yourself. You're doing a fabulous job in this interview. You're teaching me things, teaching us things that are not obvious, and they're really wise. They're really great, and I appreciate you, Paul.
Thank you, Marty. That's great.
Yeah, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco with my guest, Paul Falcone, the author of 101 Tough Conversations to Have with Employees. What is your question or comment for him?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a disabled veteran who's been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and in a way I'm speaking for millions of veterans out there who have this same issue. Because of the campaigns to employ veterans, one of the things I find is that many job counselors have told people like myself not to disclose that we have our disability because we will be perceived, and this is what I was told, as a ticking time bomb. I notice there is a subtle job discrimination out there for those of us who disclose that we have this kind of disability. And the question here is, when should I disclose or should I refrain from disclosing? And thank you for this program.
Great question. Thank you so much for the call. Paul, go ahead.
Wow. That is an excellent question.
Yep.
Thank you for sharing because it's very open and it's very honest. The truth of the matter is, companies, I don't want to sound Pollyannish here, but a lot of companies are trying so much to get veterans back into the workplace. They need to do it from a practical basis for affirmative action reasons, right? Because they usually have affirmative action plans and these types of things. But it's also the right thing to do. I mean, you can't go to a ball game without singing God Bless America at the seventh inning stretch and seeing the bumper sticker saying we support our troops. The biggest challenge I think employers have is they don't know how to interpret what people did in the military and try and figure out, well, how is that going to apply to the workplace, and how do I understand what they did before in terms of what they'll be able to do here?
Paul, I'm going to interrupt. That's all well and good for a vet who's honorably discharged, who's got no issues, but this guy says he's a disabled vet who has PTSD. That is, he may have emotional flashbacks, he's highly sensitive. you know, what if he were your brother? And you were being a wise person, both understanding the world of human resources, but also humanity. You're being a wise man here. What his question was: what should you disclose and when?
Yeah, and again, it's funny, Marty. I can't be anyone's conscience for them. If you disclose it, the chances that you'll get hired will be much slimmer.
Yeah.
Not because people are afraid you're going to blow up. People are afraid of ADA claims. The Americans with Disabilities Act,
yep.
Punitive damages if you do not, as a company, comply with its its rules and regulations.
Right.
On the other hand, if you're going into a work environment where you're not sure you're going to be able to perform on a day-to-day basis, you have the right to have these ADA, discussions about reasonable accommodations in the pre-employment process.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to say, the way I would answer this is, look, I'll be honest, from a practical standpoint, anyone who comes in and states any kind of mental disability, their chances of getting hired will be slimmer.
True.
But there's no reason to put yourself in harm's way if you're not sure you'll be able to do that job fully. That's not good for you or good for the employer. And the goal of all this stuff is not to generate lawsuits and make all the drama happen in your life.
Let me try something. Let me try pretending that I am this guy, and I'm going to try to be fully disclosing and fully honest in the hope that, yes, more employers will reject me, but the right employer will say yes. And I will say the following. I did serve in the front lines of Iraq, and I saw a lot of death and mayhem. And as a result, I have suffered, I've got, you know, what they call PTSD. That means that I might get highly sensitive to certain situations. I might be better off having some more privacy or control of my environment. But there's also pluses. Having seen life all from all sides has created a human being who is extremely ethical and sensitive to other people's sensitivities. And so if perchance you are willing to give somebody like, if you need somebody like that, I think I would be a loyal and worthy net employee. We all have weaknesses. I've tried to be extremely candid with you about mine. Might you be willing to take a shot at least talking further with me to see if I might be a good fit in your organization? What might you, if you were the HR person, say to me?
I would say I think it's wonderful that you've disclosed that. And I want to talk to you about that because we need to talk about the role. And what we have in our case is we have a job description. Some companies don't. But even if you don't, you can still talk about what those essential functions of the job would be like and whether or not you think you'd be able to do these without some form of accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
So let me tell you about this role that you're applying for. Mm-hmm. And in light of the context of these like primary things that you'll be responsible for, you tell me how you think that would work. And my caveat up here is I'm not going to give you an answer on the spot.
This sure.
is something that I'll definitely, you know, discuss with people who are a little more versed in this because I don't know much about PTSD.
Right.
But at the same thing, I want to hear what you think would work for you or what might be challenging and see if we can make this work.
Great. And now that was taking kind of the liberal kumbaya, you know, nicey-nicey position. But now I'm going to make the argument for hiring this guy if he can at all do the job from a kind of a cold-hearted business perspective. What a great PR bonanza. If I can get this guy who's diagnosed with PTSD hired and successful, and with his acknowledgement and permission, make him a poster boy for what a great company we are, I might get a lot more sales and a lot more business because I hired the guy. Is that dreaming? Am I too far from the corporate realities for that to be a real factor, or would that actually be a legitimate merit-based consideration?
Yeah, I think it would in many companies. But I'm going to go beyond that.
Sure.
A lot of times, the initial employer response to these things, Marty, is, well, is there a PR boon if we do it that way? Or is there a legal risk if we don't do it or whatever? And my answer is half the time, most of the time, it's like, forget all that stuff.
Hmm.
What's the right thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
I think too many times we all get so lost in the sense of, oh, legal, blah, blah, blah. Oh, there's a publicity, you know, boost to this. There's a watershed moment.
Mm-hmm.
All of that stuff I understand and I get it, and that's background
mm-hmm.
noise.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of the matter is if you've got someone who has got the wherewithal, maturity, the business maturity to present their case the way you presented it to me, and basically, as an employer, I'm going to sit back and say, my God, this is exactly the kind of person. I mean, his emotional quotient for intelligence must be through the roof. Let's figure out if we can do this, though, because it all depends. if this is someone who says he has a proclivity to hurting people or
right,
hurting himself,
right,
that's going to give me a different response
right.
than if he says, well, Paul actually just keeps me up at night, and that's really, you know, I have bad dreams. I don't know yet. We'll figure that out, but that's how the dialogue usually gets moving.
I got to tell you, if I were the CEO and I was establishing policy, I would, you know, I'm looking at what is going to create the greatest overall good for my company. It could be a nonprofit or government agency. And, you know, whether the guy can do the job or not is relatively incrementally small in terms of the value of the company. But if he could be a PR bonanza, that's got a lot bigger impact on my company. So, frankly, I would consider that significantly. You think I'm wrong. I know, but that's just a take.
Hey, no. It's not a right or wrong. Please, it's not right or wrong. And I hear exactly where you're coming from. And I would think the same thing, too. But it speaks to who we are as an organization.
Yep.
And that, to me, is more important than all of these other little, you know, sidebar arguments about, you know, what happens if we're sued and what happens if, you know, we get on national public radio because we're a company that was able to do this successfully. Those things
right.
are fine, but you've got to look for the humanity in it first.
Very good. All right, let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and my guest, Paul Falcone, the author of 101 Tough Conversations to Have with Employees. What is your question or comment for him?
Hello?
Hi, it's you. Uh-huh.
Hi. Yes, okay. I've been an EEO representative for the last 30-some years.
Good.
And I just wanted to share with you that from my experience, people that have come to me to file an EEO, you know, came to me because they've endured a lot of pain and suffering. And oftentimes people don't want to just the first time it happens. They think it could be a fluke. They mm-hmm. they dismiss it. They hope that it doesn't happen again. They don't want to appear to be a crybaby.
Mm.
You know, and the list goes on. And I really think that from my experience with my HR department, they tend to think always that the complainant is the one that's just, you know, blowing hot air. There's no basis in reality. And oftentimes the people themselves don't realize that they have a problem until it's been exasperated. They don't think, believe it or not, from my experience, they don't think, oh, the first time it happens, oh, they're just after me because I'm black or because I'm a woman. That's like the last, really. And so for the way you've come across to me today, so far I've been listening, it's almost like you want to dismiss or make the people that are filing the suit, the discrimination, kind of like, oh, they're just doing it because they may have been disciplined or in the process of getting disciplined, when in fact there are a lot of people. I've encouraged people to file EEOs because I've seen the toll that it's taken on them, and don't forget the toll that it takes on the family, because this worker who's endured a lot of horrible things at work, when they go home, they can't turn it off. And so I just wanted to bring that perspective because I don't hear it from your guest, and I just have a lot of empathy. I'll give you one concrete example. One Hispanic woman, Latina, we have like a redress where you get to face the person that you feel has been discriminating against you, and so it takes a heck of a lot of courage, believe me, to sit across the table from somebody that you feel that has been treating you unfairly, dismissive, blah, blah, blah. So for 2 weeks before, she lost sleep. And her daughter, the day that she was supposed to have the redress, and she lives way over, gosh, I mean, it's like Antioch or something, and she had to drive to the city, and her mother left, it starts really early. Her daughter made her breakfast because she knew, you know, she just wanted to support her mom. So I just wanted to share that because to file a suit, there might be one. I haven't even met one person that did it just because, you know, as a to try to counter the discipline that's coming down the tube or something. The ones I've dealt with are people that really have been struggling, and this is in the Bay Area, and this is in liberal San Francisco, and this is like discrimination because they were black, because they were a woman, et cetera, et cetera. So, and this is in the last 20, 30 years. So. Anyways, that's all I have to say.
Have you been listening to the show from the very beginning, or did you join us after the beginning?
No, I've been listening.
Because in the very beginning, the very first thing we said, and he agreed, is that the vast majority of employees are honest, hardworking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if you missed that.
I missed that.
Yeah, okay. But your perspective, nonetheless, is very valuable, and I appreciate you having called.
Thank you.
Okay. Paul, what has been, in your judgment, she's saying that she never in 30 years has seen a case where there was real malingering in making a claim. You've also been around for a couple of decades in the belly of the beast in HR. From your perspective, what would you say is the percentage of, I know you say it's a matter of perception, but if God or the goddess were looking down upon all the claims that you have seen, what percentage would the god or goddess say were legitimate, for example, discrimination or sexual harassment, and what percentage were at least significantly exaggerated or malingered?
Oh, Marty, God bless you. What a good question that is. I would be remiss to try and put a percentage on it. Let me throw a quick thought at you, though.
Sure.
For the caller who just called in, I 100% agree with her. I'm not coming across from a standpoint of saying that, the employers are right and the employers are wrong. And if human resources professionals or anyone else ever appears to dismiss people too easily, especially if it's a first-time complaint, that's really a problem. One of the reasons why I think my books have always sold well is, number one, I kind of focus on the how-to as opposed to the what. Everyone knows what to do, they just don't know how to do it. But secondly, there's a spiritual element that I've always been able to incorporate and weave into my writing that I think resonates with people out there. Now, I'm not naive enough to say that every human resources professional approaches these things the way Paul Falcone does. It's not. We're all different. And I'm not saying I'm perfect or have some higher standard. But the reality becomes, I think, when we look at things in the sense of what is best for the individual involved, it just makes it better for everybody.
Yeah.
I hear where she's coming from. She sees the receiving end of some ugly cases, and when you're steeped in that for three decades or two decades or whatever, you tend to see that as the all. Kind of like they say police officers. They tend to see the harder things in society for so long, it impacts them. I see it on the other side of the belly of the beast, as you call it, and I've seen many people who have tried to take advantage of companies or companies' good intentions or, an overactive plaintiff bar that tries to find ill intentions where there necessarily weren't any. But the reality is the answers are it's everywhere across the spectrum. We all stand up for what we think is the right thing to do, and that's what we should do. That doesn't take away from my experience as an HR guy, nor should it take away from the experience of an EEO representative. Both sides are really important to me.
What is really interesting to me from a meta perspective here is that the caller said she listened to the whole show, and yet not only did she not hear what I said, that the vast majority of people are ethical, etc., but I really made clear, embedded even in the question, when I talked about the person who claimed a sexual or discrimination case, I asked, how do her claim, of course, could be legitimate. Those were the exact words I used, yet she didn't hear that. All she heard was her side. And that's the trouble, I frankly think, in all of our discussions about race and gender especially, that we have such strong feelings on whatever side of the equation that we hear what we want to hear and then we jump to inferences, perceptions about people's intentions or values, racism and sexism, without really hearing. Is it fair that we really, especially when we're dealing with issues of race, gender, sexual orientation, class, age, all those isms, that we need to redouble our efforts to try to truly listen to what is being said and not overinterpret, not have our antennas so finely tuned that we're hearing what's really not even being underneath the surface?
Yeah, I hear you. But you know what? We are all human beings, and we're doing the best we can. There's an expression I use that says, no one does anything wrong given their model of the world. And we really do. We try and make things make sense for us. There are just certain ways, certain things we can do that maybe they're not right or wrong, but they just don't serve us. They're not in our best interest to do things and to do things a certain way. And I think your point about maybe listening more openly and looking more objectively at things for everybody who's on this call, myself included, that would just benefit all of us.
Before we go back to the phones, I kind of want to redirect away from where I wanted. There's so many kind of tough conversations with employees that one could have that are apart from this stuff. I know that's the hot button issue, but I think there are some maybe more pervasive and important issues that a manager, HR manager or otherwise, would have to deal with. For example, let's say someone is very quiet. They contribute very little. It's an employee we're talking about. An employee is very quiet, contributes very little in meetings, makes very few suggestions, just does his or her work, does an adequate job, certainly. When would you simply accept that But that's an individual difference. That's an introvert. Not everybody is going to be contributing in meetings. And when would you intervene and how would you intervene?
Yeah, good question. Now, if someone is just introverted and that's their style, no harm, no foul, and we can respect that. But what really happens more often than not is not only are they just introverted and quiet, but they didn't foxhole themselves. And they want to be left alone, and everyone's going to lunch, but this person stays behind. That's more the reality that I see.
Mm.
And that's when you've got the person who really needs a hand to say, hey, I want you to feel included in this group. I mean, the reality is you look at steps of what happens in the process as people disengage from their employers. And one of the first things you see is when that time clock mentality really starts to kick in and they don't want to deal with anyone else. They really don't, in my world, my opinion, they don't have the right to do that. We are a team. We work together as a team. And we expect everyone to be comfortable with each other and not walking on eggshells with one another. So you can sit with that person and say, I respect the fact that you're quiet and you don't necessarily feel a need to contribute certain ideas and thoughts at a staff meeting. But my perception is that you're pulling away from the rest of the group and that people have a harder time addressing things with you because you don't make them feel welcome. And now that's only a perception. I'm not saying that's real. I'm not saying it's intentional. But share with me, is that something that you think others might describe you as? And what I want to do is I want to give them that open-ended forum, Marty, to be able to tell me, well, Paul, you know, maybe they do feel that way about me, but I don't mean anything about it, and blah, blah, blah. Then you can take that conversation and say, okay, well, tell me what this might look like. What might be some of the other assumptions that people on the team have about dealing with you or coming to you with a question? And then you can take that to another step, which says, now tell me, how do you think we can make this better? What would it feel like on your end if you felt like you were more part of the team and you were more included, and what could you do to make others feel welcome in working with you a bit more? And see, that's where you want to take these conversations. It's not that they're quiet. It's really that they withhold themselves, that they foxhole themselves, and that becomes the problem. And then everyone's walking on eggshells and keeping a distance from Paul Falcone over there because he's, you know, it's kind of hard to deal with him, so we don't work with him. That's not what you want. God forbid. We don't want people feeling isolated. It happens. I get it. And as an HR guy, when I see these situations, I can identify them in a second. But then you have to meet with that person and find out what is it makes them feel that way.
Paul, I'm
and
not
how
so,
do you heal the wound?
Yeah, I'm not so sure, Paul. You know, not everybody needs to be a team player. If there's somebody of the classic stereotype of the computer programmer geek who's just he or she may have social anxiety, but can make an enormous contribution. I am less concerned about whether that person goes out to lunch and feels like part of the team, and more, frankly, about the contributions in the meetings. So I'd be more inclined to say something like, I'm noticing, you know, you're clearly a bright guy. I look or a woman, and I look at your work, and it's really high quality, and you have a lot of good ideas. And yet, in the meetings where we really want back and forth, brainstorming about what to proceed, how to proceed, critiquing of ideas, you're not contributing very much. Is there anything that I can do to make it a more hospitable place so that you can feel okay about it? Or if you're just really shy about speaking up because you need a little more time to reflect, some people do, would you want to, I'd be happy to give you an open door. You can send me your email comments or suggestions later. How can I better serve you? Because my job as your manager is not one size fits all to make everybody into a clone team player or whatever. It is to help each and every one of you flower. How can I best enable you to contribute those good ideas that you have? Do you think that approach is misguided?
No, I would have written that in my book. I could have quoted you on that one. I love it. Again, there's a difference, though. Your interpretation of this one, and I see where you're coming from now. Your interpretation on this one is there's no problem with conduct or resentment or a lack of teamwork or anything. It's just someone who's quiet and who's not participating in group conversations.
Right.
But everything else is fine. And under those circumstances, what you said is an A+. In reality, more people than not, I don't find that they're so quiet. It can happen, but it's rare.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they're so quiet that they won't talk to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, when you see that, it's like where there's smoke, there's fire.
Mm.
And there's usually some underlying resentment. And what I'm saying is you have to kind of get to whatever that core item is because there's an emotional disconnect.
Okay, good.
And that's the thing that usually keeps people away from participating with the rest of the team.
Thank you very much. Okay, I have a question that came in writing. And, you know, before we're going to go back to the phones in a minute. Let me see if I can make sense of this. It says, with a senior employee who's difficult, won't change, and can't be terminated. would you recommend something called the 90-10 rule? Isolate this person, have others more capable and easier to work with surround him, and take over his key responsibilities. Is that an effective strategy?
Well, I've never heard of the 90-10 rule.
Me neither.
My gut tells me I absolutely hate it, because what it says is it legitimizes the fact that this person gets to set him or herself apart from the rest of the group, and it puts everyone else in control of basically doing that person's work, and all you're going to get as a result of that is a bitter employee who feels more and more isolated over time.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Paul Falcone, the author of 101 Tough Conversations to Have with Employees. What is your question or comment for him?
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Perfectly.
I work at a labor management partnership, and a lot of times at meetings, many employees will not contribute. They are very silent, and only a few...
It's just what we talked about a moment ago.
Yes. And my interpretation is it's not so much a psychological introversion. I think it has more a matter of trust. They don't feel trustful that the environment is conducive to actually taking their ideas, and that in the long term they do feel taken for granted. Now, you mentioned earlier half of your evaluation is a performance, the other half is conduct. We have a quarterly evaluation of lower employees. Many of us feel, what about reverse evaluation? I think the company is also obligated to see itself, how are we doing as far as performance and conduct? And I think a lot of times silence in the room betokens not any particular individual deficiency on that part, but it's, if the organization is not quite fully functional or perhaps dysfunctional, that may be a clue why employees are not contributing. Now, going back to the bulldozer, some employees are going...
You know, before we go from topic to topic here, hold on a second. So the implicit question in there is one of that many employees distrust the employer. They feel the employer is a dysfunctional workplace, and if they suggest an idea that is contrary to what management wants, they're going to be dinged. What do you have a response, Paul? I mean, obviously you can't speak to all business, but as somebody who has been in companies like Nickelodeon and Time Warner at senior levels and Paramount Pictures, to what extent is employee distrust, fear of coming up with new ideas that are contrary to, you know, not, it's standard wisdom that being a yes man or woman is a safe way to survive in corporate America, to kiss the boss's butt.
Right.
To what extent is challenging the boss in private or in a meeting really likely to backfire?
A wonderful question. We could talk about this one for an hour.
Right.
It's called the company's dysfunctionality quotient, and every company has one. It's just a matter of degree.
Right.
But the caller asked the perfect question. How do you get trust back in that room so that people can actually feel like they can talk without either being retaliated against or sticking their neck out? Because there's that proverb that says if you're the nail that's sticking out of the wood, you're the one who's going to get hammered. The suggestion of can we do reverse evaluations on the company, I don't think that's really an answer. That'll come out in exit interviews and climate surveys. So you kind of, if you do any of those, you're probably getting that feedback already. But the reality is the answer won't be fixed in a large group. That answer has to be fixed one-on-one by the leadership team with their immediate direct reports. When you sit with someone and say, hey, listen, Marty, what I realize is no one's talking out there. And usually when people aren't talking out there, it's maybe because there's a lack of trust. And I get that. And I'm not expecting to change this overnight so that next week we're going to have a meeting and everyone's going to be talking. But we need to change the culture because I want people to feel more comfortable being able to express their opinions and that type of thing. Tell me what your thoughts are. You're my strongest player, and I'd like to hear your feedback. So you start with your strongest, and it's very complimentary that you're asking them to make themselves part of the solution. And then you build those relationships one by one, and 6 months from now people will start talking. But it's going to take time. You don't fix these things overnight.
Caller, I want to thank you for the call because we have so many. I know you wanted to talk about brainstorming, but I'm going to, because we've got so many calls and I have a lot of important questions that I think would benefit the large listenership, that I want to do that. What if I've heard employees tell me, Paul, that every manager says, yes, I have an open door. Yes, I want to hear your feedback. Yes, and whatever. And in the end, empirically, what happens is the risk is great. The daring to disagree with the boss does not result in a positive response, but it's human nature to simply want a yes person. Is it really realistic to encourage people to go and disagree with the boss?
Well, kind of depends. Marty, again, it's a great question, and what we're saying is let's look in people's hearts and see what's mm-hmm. really there. And, of course, we can't know that. I don't recommend that people engage in what I call career-limiting moves by sticking their neck into the guillotine and then handing the boss the button and saying, oh, you're not going to push the button. You've got to be realistic. It is a very tough time in corporate America these days because people are exhausted. Mm-hmm. They have not stopped working like animals for the last dozen years.
I know.
And whether we're in a massive recession or there's a really tight labor market and they can't find people, it's like every 3 years the cycle starts all over again. The ones who have been fortunate enough to stay employed, though, they're not only exhausted, they're frightened because they know people who have lost their homes or they know people who have been laid off and been unemployed for over a year. These are tough times, and you don't always see the best part of humanity mm-hmm. when people are all running for their life jackets.
Yep.
So the reality is you have to make these decisions on a wise basis, on a case-by-case basis, and it will depend on the level of trust you have in your boss. If the answer is you have that trust and you can make yourself vulnerable a little bit and share what your true feelings are, have that meeting. The boss needs to hear that. Mm-hmm. But if you feel like the reality is they're telling me one thing and they're going to snap that guillotine on me if mm-hmm. I say anything, then I don't think you're going to fix anything realistically. So better just to kind of tamp it down and kind of go about doing your business.
Or change employers if you can.
Change employers, right.
Yeah. You know, the callers' comments and questions have been fabulous. I want to take as many as I can. But there are a couple of core questions that I need to ask you that are so common in terms of these tough conversations. Let's say one of your supervisees consistently does less work or lower quality work than his or her peers. If you were the manager or the HR manager, how would you handle? You're not ready to. How would you handle that?
Yeah, and I think that when you're looking at quality and productivity types of issues,
right.
As a manager, you have to have high expectations. You can't measure down and say, "Well, everyone else is doing up here, but it's okay that you're down here at this level." What you do is you talk with someone. Now you can sit with them and say, let me show you the statistics. Tell me what your thoughts are. Or you can talk to someone about their error ratio or the quality of the work that they're doing and say, you tell me your thoughts. Am I missing something? Is there a reason why your performance is consistently at this level? Because I need to share with you, Marty, this isn't an acceptable level. We're raising the bar for everybody. But I don't think these are unreasonable standards. So tell me how we can help you get there or tell me if I'm missing something. And I think when you have that kind of conversation, it's fair, it's honest. They may not like hearing it, but they'll respect the way you handled it. And at that point, they'll get that message. They don't have to wait till their performance review to come out to find out that they didn't meet expectations.
Okay, let's go one more. I have two more. I got to ask you two more, and then we'll go to the phones. And I appreciate the conciseness of your answer because we're running up against the clock. Let's say you've got a workplace in which most people dress conventionally, but one person who is not in a customer-facing position, let's say just got a spiky purple hairstyle, a nose ring, and an armful of, and now she's wearing, or he is wearing short sleeve shirts and an armful of tattoos. How would you handle that?
Yeah, that's a tough conversation now, isn't it? All of a sudden, they had an epiphany, and they decided they were going to go out and get things pierced and tattoos and everything else.
Right.
And you're an investment banking firm, so it really makes it kind of tough. But their argument is there's a privacy issue, and their argument is, but I'm not in a customer-facing
right.
role.
Right.
But the employer's argument is, but can't you see what the culture is of the organization? What I think is the best thing to do is to call the person into a meeting one-on-one. Share with them that you respect the fact that they have every right to do whatever they want to in terms of body art or self-expression.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is it is causing some concerns and eyebrows being raised because our environment is very much not like that. Let's talk about how we can make this happen so that both sides can reasonably have their expectations met. Now, that means they may have to wear long sleeves. Or usually, if you treat people respectfully, this has always been my experience,
mm-hmm.
they will meet you halfway.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to sit there usually and mm-hmm. pound on the table and say, I have every right to do this and I don't
mm-hmm.
care.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually going to say, you know what, you were cool, and let me figure out a way that we can do this, and you find out a way to do it. But, look, it could ultimately be an employment decision. I'm not lying about this.
Mm-hmm.
If you absolutely refuse, and you will not comply and you're looking for a reason to be fired, most employees in California are at will.
You know what?
If you're that far out of lockstep with the rest of the organization culturally, it could result that way, but it should be easy enough to avoid.
I think I'd be trying to take an even more liberal stance on this. What if I said, and I'm curious really what you think, I really am honestly interested in what you think about, I want you to disagree with me. I know this is not the perfect example, but I shop at Trader Joe's all the time. And I noted that at the Berkeley store, not perhaps not surprisingly, that there are a number of their workers who, unlike the Lafayette store, where I also sometimes shop, who have piercings, body art, spiky hair, or whatever. And you know what? And they're in customer-facing positions. And my first visceral reaction was, a little weird. But you know what? After a while, it feels like, great. I quickly got to the point where I judge the person on the quality of who they are, not on their body art. So, we don't want employers to be so rigid. What if I said it really wouldn't hurt the overall company productivity or anything else to say, I would say to this person, of course, because we have a kind of a buttoned-up culture here, you're paying a price for this, but I will support you all the way. I'm not convinced that your choice of aesthetics is something that I should say is a rule or not, or come a compromise. If you're willing to take the price in the other's perception, you will have my support. Do you think that's a mistake?
No. There's no such thing as right or wrong, though, in these things, because I think the reality becomes, in a Trader Joe's type of environment, that's fine.
Even in an investment banking environment, if I had one person who was a fine, quality employee, but that person was my edgy one, who, whatever reason, she or he is trying some new persona on, she wants to be more visible, feels anonymous and wants to do that, and that's a phase or a stage, I don't think I would make that something I would, insist you wear long sleeves.
Good. Now, here's my problem. I totally agree with you, person to person. That doesn't bother me. But the usual issue is it doesn't have to bother me, the HR guy. It's the CEO who noticed. And now she's the one coming to me telling me, hey, Paul, you need to kind of fix that because that's not acceptable around here. And then the tough conversation gets invoked. So even if you don't feel personally that it's that much of an issue, you have to find a way to do this that gets respect, that it's respectful, that people feel like they can hear what your issue is and you're looking for a reasonable compromise. It's very rare that doesn't work. People can sit back and say, no, I absolutely refuse to comply because this new ring, even though I can take it out of my cheek or whatever, I'm not going to do it. Or you can have an employer who bangs the hand down on the desk and says that person must be fired. But those are so extreme, Marty.
Okay, let's not talk about the
extremes. It doesn't really happen.
Fair enough. I'd be maybe I'm watching too many Hollywood movies, but I'd be inclined to at least write a one-liner to the CEO making the case for having an anomalous person is maybe even a net positive. And then if the CEO said no, then I'd fall in the line. But I would probably briefly make my case with the CEO. You think that's crazy?
No, but we're dealing with people. There's nothing right or wrong. It's really what's in the best interest of you and the company. So, no, I don't think that's crazy at all. It's a great suggestion. I wish I thought of it.
All right. One more question before we go to the phones. Substance abuse. Unfortunately, because, like you say, everybody's running around fast. Everybody's exhausted. Everybody's scared. There is a lot of substance abuse. And, in fact, in 3 states, we know we've legalized marijuana, and likely in California. And I'm betting the next few years we're going to have much more legalization. The media is really jumping on it. They want to see legalization. So substance abuse has long been a problem and likely will continue to be a problem, if not an increasing one. So your book actually gives an example of when a manager or a coworker observes that an employee often appears under the influence. How would you handle that?
Yeah, again, if you look at it from truly the employee's best interest, it's a matter of sitting with the person and saying, I'm not saying that you are under some influence, but it appears from what I can see that you may be impacted somehow, and I want to talk about that. And if that's the case, I want to, you have to understand something. You have a very strict anti-drug policy in this company, as do most organizations, and we need to talk about it because truthfully, again, Marty, so employers have a lot of discretion on this. They can march you off right to a testing lab if they suspect they have a reasonable suspicion, and that kind of testing is allowable, and if you test positive, you're out the door. Sometimes employers don't want to go that far. They want to see how you're doing. This is aberrant behavior. This isn't the kind of behavior they typically see. Is there something going on that we can help with? We have an employee assistance program that we can help you with. There's a million different ways to approach this, all depending on how the employee comes back at you. And if the employee says, Paul, yeah, I've got a problem, and ever since blah, blah, blah happened, my life has really taken a turn for the worse. That tells me that someone needs help, and I'm so glad I intervened. If the person says, get out of my business and you can't prove anything, the employer's obviously going to respond a little differently to something like that, and it'll be a more formal response, which may invoke some kind of testing. And then if you do test positive, it could result in the termination. There's a lot of protections around this, though, and there's a lot of issues around ADA And, you know, is the person regarded as having this, is it a disability? Is it active use of the drug? Are they in a protection, or are they in a drug treatment policy program? There's a lot here. So it's a little tough to answer in 30 seconds, but
right.
Like I will always say, answer with your heart. Do it with the best interests of the person. Treat them with the respect and see if you can help them with anything before this thing gets worse or there's some problem that really manifests itself.
Okay, we have time for one quick call. You know, Paul, I'm going to have you back. I've got a number of questions that are really important, issues about Family and Medical Leave Act, terminations, layoffs, how to handle it. We're not going to have time to talk about that, but you're great. I'm going to have you back. Let's take one more call, though. I'm trying to give primacy to my dear listeners. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Paul Falcone, the author of 101 Tough Conversations to Have with Employees. What is your question? A comment for him. Briefly, please, because we are running out of time. It is you.
Hello?
Yes, it is you. Hello.
Oh, hi. sorry, I just wanted to make clear a quick comment, a question.
Sure.
HR is there to protect the company or organization from liability. it would be great if it was possible to just have a conversation about how to handle a recalcitrant employee or manager, with it being off the record, but nothing is off the record in HR. So employees, I mean, if I experience something, I just keep a stiff upper lip and try to ignore it, what's happened to me or how someone's treated me. I'd rather not come up on the radar as a problem employee. And that leads me into my question. I'm very interested in career development, and I always give my all, and I want to move ahead. So I have run into many instances of lip service given to career development at a company where they tout it but yet don't offer any time to actually go do it and get the additional training to move up the ladder. So either making the career dev available offline when people can do it on their own time, or actually putting real teeth behind people moving up and getting the career dev they need to enhance their career.
I want to thank you for the call because we are just about out of time. You've got, Paul, I want to give you just a few seconds. Why don't you talk just a bit about, that is the normal view, that most employees realize that HR is there to protect the company and therefore they want to stay off the radar and then they tend to not go to human resources. What's your quick answer to his assertion?
I wouldn't agree.
Okay.
Human resources is going to be a 51-49 proposition. More people in my HR classes that I teach will say that they're there to protect employees as opposed to being there to protect companies.
Mm.
And that's not necessarily a good answer. I'm not saying that's the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
But there is this perception, Marty, that HR is there to protect the company. And I would say, you know, of course we're there to protect the company, but we're also there to protect the employee. If we're doing it the right way, there's no need for a union, for example, where the union would have to come in and protect the employees, because the HR department is doing it the right way and finding that balance. It's too easy to just simply sit back and assume that HR has the wrong motives here or they're on the wrong side of the line. Again, I think finding the balance is a challenge that HR people have, but is a very, very important aspect of who your company is and what the culture is all about. HR does dictate that. And unfortunately, if HR teams are seen strictly as extensions of the company's leadership and management, the HR teams are kind of missing out on some of the more important aspects of what they should be doing.
Well, I think you've covered some of the more important aspects of those indeed tough conversations that employees have with employers. The book, again, is 101 Tough Conversations to Have with Employees by Paul Falcone. A lot of his writings and information about his 9 books are at paulfalconehr.com. His last name is spelled F-A-L-C-O-N-E. Paul, thanks very much for giving me part of your Sunday.
Oh, thanks, Marty. My pleasure.
Okay, and that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. My thanks to my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday. I'm really excited about the show. I'll talk with Jaron Lanier. He's one of Time Magazine's 2010 100 Most Influential People and author of a great book, Who Owns the Future? We're going to kick around ideas for how to create many more middle-class jobs. The guy is great. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us. Growth among those who don't.